Probably the craziest story that we've ever been involved with has just come to a conclusion. Recently, a court in California, a federal court, held that a group of companies controlled by a Chinese billionaire named Liu Zhongtian were criminally liable for evading about $1.8 billion in U.S. tariffs. This story is something that started more or less with a report that we did, Muddy Waters, pseudonymously. So back in 2015, caught up with the funds that's pretty smart money, and they said to us, this is right up your alley. There's this company listed in Hong Kong called Zhongwang, and they've got over $1 billion of aluminum just sitting in the desert in Mexico. This thing's a fraud. My first question was, well, what would the point of that fraud be? I mean, if you've got $1 billion sitting in Mexico, where did the money come from? Now, what we didn't know at that time, but would later find out, is that this is money, roughly $5 billion, that we think had been just defrauded out of Chinese banks. And what we were seeing was the laundering taking place. But right after they brought Zhongwang up, Freddie said, oh yeah, I know that company.
So China Zhongwang is funny because it was always a fraud. The fraud changed from being just a traditional stock market fraud to something a bit realer and much wilder. But I remember from when I was working at a hedge fund in Hong Kong prior to Muddy Waters, Zhongwang had listed. Typical at the time for some of these Chinese companies, they didn't give you the customer list. And so it was, you know, customer A, B, C, and then maybe they told people who a few of the customers were just through some pretty rudimentary checks, some short sellers and I think some journalists as well had called the customers up and basically asked them if they bought what they claimed off China Zhongwang, and they said no. So immediately after the IPO, there was a tremendous amount of skepticism as to, you know, whether the company's revenues were real, whether the company's customers were real, whether the factories were real. And, you know, that probably should have been where it ended. But these guys had other plans, and yeah, I'm glad they did, because, you know, in all the work we've done at Muddy Waters, I think this was some of the most interesting, certainly some of the most shocking, and yeah, I'm pleased to see with the recent pronouncement from the DOJ, you know, work where we've ultimately been proven correct, albeit not without some significant financial cost and pain in between.
The Economic Observer, which is a mainland paper, reported at the time of Zhongwang's IPO that I think five of the customers that Zhongwang was claiming purchased from it were not purchasing from it or were not purchasing in those quantities. And then also the South China Morning Post reported that two of Zhongwang's claimed customers had lower annual revenue than Zhongwang claimed to be selling them in prior years. That automatically was the cause for skepticism there from the media. So Zhongwang claimed to be the second largest manufacturer of aluminum extrusions in Asia. Aluminum extrusions are aluminum forms that are commonly used in buildings, windows, and other products like those. The issue, though, is that the demand actually wasn't there. All of this stuff that it was producing was actually being bought by the chairman of the company, who had taken out these loans from PRC banks that at the time we were certain he would never repay, and I'm assuming never did repay. This was turned into aluminum extrusions, shipped overseas, but was not allowed to enter the United States without massive duty attached to it. So most of it ended up in Mexico, some in Vietnam, some in Malaysia. And in Mexico, they were deprocessing it. They were taking it from this more finished product, an aluminum extrusion, melting them down into these enormous industrial sized billets, and then trying to sell it onward.
I think it would be remiss, we didn't give credit to a journalist at Aluminum Metals Monthly, which I must confess is not something I had previously subscribed to and generally has not been a wonderful source of short ideas. This had the massive amount of aluminum in the desert in Mexico had not gone unnoticed by the aluminum industry and was actually causing a significant amount of concern. And so this journalist was, you know, to my knowledge, the first guy who basically went, commissioned or took his own drone, flew it over these facilities and shot these amazing photos of, you know, what a couple $1 billion actually looks like, just sat there shining in the desert.
And the really funny thing is they applied, the company in Mexico that they'd set up, which was actually owned by the chairman's son at one point, that company, Aluminacast, applied to the United States government to try to get preferences under NAFTA for sending this aluminum in. So basically, you're looking at this aluminum that I think was subject to an anti-dumping duty as of 2010, these aluminum extrusions. The U.S. government posed, I think, a 374% anti-dumping duty on these extrusions. Well, they were taking these extrusions, sending them to Mexico, remelting them into billets and trying to get them into America with actual preferences from NAFTA. So that was a big part of what was going on. They did send some of these directly to the US, in particular to a company in California called Perfectus. And they didn't pay the duties on that aluminum because what they did was they took these extrusions, welded them together to make these pallets that they claimed were actually for shipping. But the average Zhonghuang pallet, aluminum pallet, was about 165 pounds, which was way too heavy. I mean, aluminum pallets are a very niche market, but they'll weigh about 50 pounds. So anyway, they then sent all this into California, no end buyer for most of it. And the U.S. government ended up seizing a bunch of it. And that's when the U.S. government filed the criminal case alleging that the Leos and all these companies evaded the $1.8 billion in U.S. duties.
As we've discussed, there was kind of the stock market fraud angle of let's make up some customers and dump some stock on some unsuspecting punters in Hong Kong, which then merged this, well, let's defraud the U.S. government as we try and do backflips to get into the U.S. But there was also an angle of fraud both on Chinese banks, which may or may not have been condoned. My strong belief is people at the banks were paid off, and I don't know if the banking system's underwater by hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars, what's a few more billion to throw into that? And in addition, there was this land Ponzi scheme they had going on as well. So, you know, I don't know if you want to call it innovative or just hand-to-mouth survival to keep robbing Peter to pay Paul, but they had multiple scams on at any one time. They had multiple people within the organization that were wearing multiple different hats depending on which entity they were in charge of and seemingly which day of the week it was. So it was really multifaceted and interesting in terms of the complexity of what was going on there.
I think it's easy to understate the significance of this, though, because when you looked at that time, roughly $5 billion in loans being taken out onshore by these shell trading companies that were controlled by the Leos through proxies, these were empty boxes, right? So there's like $5 billion in capital flowing to them.
One of the interesting things about Zhonghuang, too, is that it was very much, it was an incredibly complicated fraud, but it was often known by members of the public, sometimes the companies, journalists, that there was a lot of monkey business that was going on. As we spoke with formers and employees of the company, suppliers, they would often say, yes, we know XYZ company is actually Zhonghuang, or we know that, yeah, these bank guarantees are given to this little empty box company because indeed it's actually the parent who is giving the support and giving the real bank guarantee.
There's this enormous network of guarantees from all these entities just swirling all around. And look, we might have not even captured the full extent of the amount of financing that came from the banks into this. But be conservative, call it about US $5 billion. Again, these loans were made to empty boxes, okay? No way, in my mind, that happened without the acquiescence, the approval of the most senior levels of government in the PRC. And that makes total sense to me because this is kind of like the triple play as far as I'm concerned for CCP officials. Because number one, it allowed Zhongguang to keep producing aluminum, so workers remained employed. Number two, it allows China to dump aluminum and degrade the U.S.'s industrial base further. So I think this is all part of the grand strategy that, you know, we didn't really know China was employing until arguably recently. And then number three, and probably most importantly, this is real money. Like guys in the PRC government could dip their beaks into this, like $5 billion pot. So that's why I've long felt that this was the triple play, basically. And this was known about and approved of at the very highest levels.
Even though it may not be on paper, it's there. And I think that as we went through some of the research too, we found, I think it was in some of the bond prospectuses or some of the other credit reports, finding some undisclosed bank guarantees that were actually picked up in the credit reporting system. So in this regard, it's always interesting because as we kind of touched across the board, we kept finding, yes, somebody here knows that's Zhongguang. Somebody here knows that's Zhongguang. It kept coming up again and again. When we spoke to a former, it was actually a current employee of Zhongguang who had been working for Global Vietnam. He had said, quite literally, he'd been seconded and sent down to Global Vietnam Aluminum in order to go work there and help them dial in their systems. This was one of Zhongguang's major undisclosed subsidiaries.
The first thing that we do when we look at a company in China is we start pulling government filings. And so we were pulling what are called these SAIC files on Zhongguang and its various entities. There was also an obvious undisclosed related party in this trading company called Dalian Liwang. And Dalian Liwang had originally been disclosed in one of Zhongguang's prior filings. And it was pretty clear that it was an empty box, but on paper, it was exporting enormous amounts of aluminum. So we looked into Liwang, but then we also found a couple of other entities that were just like Liwang. They were these trading companies, and these were all businesses that had really no substance to them, except they had enormous liabilities and enormous accounts payable because they were getting this aluminum that they were not going to pay for, and they were just exporting it. And often those exports would then go through the Singaporean entities that were controlled by a proxy of the Liu family, this guy Eric Shen and another guy named Johnson Shao. So we were pulling the Singapore filings and we saw the same thing. So we'd see this chain of custody basically from these trading companies. They were the last ones in China to touch the aluminum, at least from a legal title perspective, going through Singapore. So once again, huge debts, you know, so huge accounts receivable, huge accounts payable, kind of matched up with what we were seeing from the PRC trading companies. And then we also had import-export records. So the export records from China were showing these Singapore intermediaries. And then we also had import records from Mexico, which were showing that the aluminum was being imported from these Singaporean intermediaries. So that's when the paper started to match up here. But we also began pulling credit reports. So People's Bank of China credit reports onshore in China. So we saw then that these three trading company entities were actually, there were guarantees to, you know, in this, we started to unravel this network of guarantees that showed us there were these intermediary companies in between Zhongguang and the trading companies. And that for the most part, these intermediary companies, which were the ones that were actually borrowing money to pay Zhongguang, or they were really paying Zhongguang, that these companies were secretly controlled by the Liu's. With one exception, one of the intermediary companies was a state-owned enterprise. think some aircraft engineering or aircraft engine production company, but that company had a public bond prospectus. So we could match up, we could see that pretty much everything it was buying from Zhongwang, it was selling to one of the three trading companies. So we're able to follow the movements on paper of the money going into the shell companies that buying the aluminum, the chain of custody of the aluminum, then to the trading companies, to Singapore, to Mexico, to Vietnam, and even to Malaysia.
I think one of the interesting things about the research on this is it really touched on probably the most multifaceted research project we've probably done. So it covered not just the usual SEICs, credit reports, filings, and when we look through the wide range of customs and import export data, China export data, U.S. import export data, Mexico import export data, going through Southeast Asia, pulling Hong Kong filings, Singapore filings, company records from throughout China plus the U.S., on the ground due diligence, plus lots of calls with formers, talking to suppliers. It was one of the most, there were many aspects of it where it was among the most adventurous projects ever done. But at the same time, it turned up some of the most bizarre moments. So, everything from container tracking going from the ports in Liaoning province down to Vietnam and trying to figure out where the containers went and staging investigators on the other side of the port to try to catch the containers coming back out and follow them down the road to the plant, to having investigators trying to scope out the facilities in Mexico and understand how big that might still be. It was definitely very complex.
Yeah, this project was real brain damage, not gonna lie. Whether it was trying to match up Singaporean filings with what we were finding in Vietnam, as the Liaos had decided to transship through either Vietnam or Australia. Trying to keep a track of what was going on at what point was really tough. Trying to put that down on paper was incredibly challenging, because these were some of the most complex flows of people, ownership, money, and goods that we probably have ever looked at.
Why did we do this pseudonymously? It was the ass watch. The ass watch. There was this huge facility in Mexico, AluminaCast, had $2 billion of aluminum sitting outside. Not a lot of this was moving. So we wanted to find out what was going on. We had paper that showed that Liu Zhuoping, who was Liu Zhongtian's son, so the chairman of Zhongwang's son, owned AluminaCast, which, by the way, was like a $200 million investment. And this 20-something-year-old kid, made it, right? And there was actually a great quote that we looked at from his father, Chairman Liu of Zhongwang, said that it's okay to give your kids some money for business, but never do business with them. But, clearly that was just a head fake. So we've got the paper showing that Liu Zhuoping owns AluminaCast, but what actually is going on? So we engaged an investigation firm, and they had people talk to the security guards, and like, this place was a fucking fortress. Razor ribbon everywhere. We also got satellite imagery. So we had we used this one firm that had former National Reconnaissance Office satellite data interpreters or overhead imagery analysts working for it. And when they're reviewing the images of this AluminaCast facility in Mexico, they noticed not only the concertina wire, but there are two sets of walls. There were various watchtowers. So they asked us at one point, is this a military installation? And we said, well, it shouldn't be. We don't think so. And the goal was to try to get somebody inside the facility to take a look at what was going on and to record it. So it took a while to set things up, but apparently they had a source who was going to go in and do it. Now, their source had once been a prisoner in Mexico. And I guess that's important because he was wearing, when he went to the facility, one of those watches that has a camera and a microphone on it. So the hidden camera. And the story that I heard was that he was going into the facility and dudes with machine guns everywhere, apparently, and up on catwalks, like a prison.
As the investigator was progressing through the facility, they were preparing to go back into some like ultra secure part of it. He had to go through some type of a security checkpoint. And at that point, he pretty much lost his shit.
And then there was a metal detector, and they were going to have him walk through the metal detector. So he realized that this could be actually a really bad thing if he got caught by these people wearing this watch. He asked to go to the bathroom, went to the bathroom, and apparently he took the watch off and shoved it up his ass.
All I know is the story we heard was, you know, a not insignificantly sized watch did disappear inside a man's ass. And based on the fear he had that the repercussions of not doing that would be much worse, he was very happy with his decision.
I didn't have the footage, but when we heard that, we said, well, we don't know what the fuck is going on here, but maybe this is different than other projects we've done.
So in the end, why didn't we do it as Muddy Waters? It's the ass watch.
That was just an amusing story, but it was clear that these are very serious guys. So Shen ended up having some nasty lawsuits between him and the Leos, I think in London and in the US. The Leos accused Shen of stealing $400 million from the Leos and that he spent on red diamonds. He spent about like $60 million on like a vintage Ferrari and a McLaren. He wrecked the McLaren. The actor who paid Mr. Bean actually, I think, like gave him roadside assistance or something when that happened. Shen claims that at one point Leo threatened him by saying, "You don't play ball. Maybe somebody's going to come up behind you, jab a needle in your neck. And when you wake up, you're going to find yourself in a shipping container in the middle of nowhere." When Zhong Wang responded, Leo gave an interview, and he also said on this investor call that, "Oh yeah, we didn't want to do anything in Mexico. You know, my son owned this business for a month, but then got rid of it because Mexico is really dangerous, and there are guys with guns there." So I think he said that publicly at least twice. You know, we were sitting there thinking, "All right, well, what do we do at this point? There are three options. One, we publish as Muddy Waters. Two, we just do nothing. Or three, we publish under a pseudonym." Our decision was to publish under a pseudonym.
So we chose Dupre Analytics after a long debate, but we thought Dupre was nice because it was actually after Ashley Dupre, the hooker that took Elliot Spitzer down. So, you know, we felt that was appropriate.
So the problem that we had once we decided that we were going to do this pseudonymously is, how do we remain pseudonymous in writing this report? Because there are really only very few people or organizations who could have done this research. And the other thing was, this was the best research we had ever done. We were literally following containers from the factory to the port in China. Then we were tracking those containers from published information on manifests. We were then having investigators meet the containers in Vietnam, following the containers, the same containers with photos and video from the port in Vietnam to the factory to the processing facility in Vietnam. We had satellite imagery that we had to address. We had recordings of employees at these proxies, at these empty box trading companies, admitting that this was all Zhongwang. So it's the best research we'd ever done, but we had to package it in a way that wasn't obviously Muddy Waters. And so I turned to Freddie to write the report. And I did that in part because Freddie has many strengths, but I don't consider writing to be among them.
So I... you know, who do you turn to when you want something written that's just about comprehensible? It's the guy with a B in A-level English. So, you know, it was truly challenging. Like, not only do I not have the penmanship skills of Carson or anyone who writes particularly well, but it was really difficult to get a hand of the entities, introducing the characters, explaining how they interacted. And, you know, ultimately, it, on top of like a lack of penmanship skills, it just made it really hard to explain in, you know, 30 to 40 pages how this was working, what the main points were, and, you know, including the most valuable bits of evidence. So unfortunately, I think that it, you know, impacted the reaction of the stock. And, you know, I think it lacking the Muddy Waters branding also made it easier for people not to take it as seriously.
We had to constantly iterate the report and again, write it stylistically in a way that we've never written a report, that I would not write a report, but trying to make it clear. And yeah, unfortunately, we didn't really hit the mark that we were aiming for. One of the things that was kind of funny, though, was we had set up a website for Dupre Analytics, and I was receiving media inquiries through that website. And there were some Chinese journalists who were skeptical of the research. I remember one of them writing something like, well, because you're not a famous research firm like Muddy Waters, why should anybody trust you? And it was just one of these moments where it's like, it sucked because I knew that the quality of the work we had done was so good, but we couldn't use the brand and we just couldn't write it the way we normally wrote it. So of course the company denied everything. Then it held a conference call. We dialed into the call. When we first dialed in, we said we were the UBS analyst. I think there were only two analysts who covered this. We got in the queue and we were called upon and we asked a question.
There's a good chance we were the only people on the call. I think we were certainly the only people who got to ask any questions. So I think one of my colleagues jumps on with a pretty unusual accent. I couldn't really place it, but at least he thought it was Norwegian.
I remember the guy who was asking the question was trying to imitate like a Dutch accent or whatever the UBS analyst accent was. And I like almost grabbed the phone out of his hands because I thought it was distracting and annoying. But anyway, then we asked the question about Mexico and that got that answer about like, oh, guys with guns, why would I let my son do business in Mexico? And then they pretty much disconnected us.
Yeah, we asked them a number of pesky questions that get to the meat of the report. So they immediately cut us off and we were in the line probably posing as the UBS analyst as well. So me again, we get back on and we ask a few more questions. And, you know, if I'm honest, I can't remember all of the dismissals, but my favorite one was we'd ask the question about how you know, Leo's son ended up owning on paper the facility down in Mexico. And yeah, the father kind of says, look, you know, I was really angry when I kind of found out about that because I always would have thought that if he wanted to be in business, he would sort of ask me. And we just thought that was so laughable, but yeah, kind of run of the mill for piss take answers to questions where you think most of your shareholders are probably stupid or disinterested anyway.
Well, I always loved the answer that he was only an owner. He only owned Alumina Casti for a month. That's just a fine, fine detail of business planning there, legacy planning.
And we ended up taking, I think, 20 to 30 minutes of time. And we got like a bunch of lies out of them. So we ended up doing a follow-up piece in which we explained what some of their lies were that they mentioned, that they told on the call or that they put out in press releases or told in other interviews. We blew those lies up. I mean, at least from a logical perspective, we blew those lies up. From a market perspective, it wasn't happening the way we would have wanted it to happen, though. After the Dupree reports, the Wall Street Journal published about a dozen articles on Zhongguang. The journalist who wrote those articles is Scott Patterson. So after the Journal puts out over a dozen articles, ratifies substantially all of our conclusions, builds upon them through sources in Mexico and elsewhere, about 2 years after publication, there's a lawsuit filed. It wasn't Zhongguang, but it was one of the companies that had been mentioned just once or twice in the reports, called Perfectus Aluminum. And Perfectus had been controlled by Zhongguang. It was part of this network of companies, and it's one of the companies that was just found criminally liable for the tariff evasion. But anyway, it's a California company. We're based in California. And then we end up in California State Court in Riverside County. And yeah, California's got this anti-slap statute under which you're supposed to be able to quickly get rid of these bullshit lawsuits that are there just to punish you. But, and this was, and the thing is they didn't assert libel. It was trade libel, which normally would only apply if we were in the same business as Perfectus. And so they were basically, the statute of limitations for just plain libel had lapsed. That was a 1 year statute. And they filed this almost 2 years after to the day, our second report. So they had to dress this up as this, what was really a libel claim under these other claims, like unfair competition as well. And really what Perfectus was asserting in his lawsuit against us is that we were being controlled by Alcoa. So it was pretty funny because when Perfectus filed the lawsuit, they filed it against Dupree Analytics and various John Does. We then came forward eventually. We answered the complaint saying, hey, we're actually Muddy Waters and we did this research, blah, blah, blah. So Perfectus was in this bizarre position where legally or factually where they're trying to argue, no, 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 Muddy Waters, they didn't really do this to sell the stock short. They were actually acting as pawns of Alcoa, and Alcoa was there pulling the strings, and this is really a trade libel case. And then at the same time, they go and sue that guy, Michael Dupree, asserting that Alcoa gave him $800,000 in a shoebox for the secure communication network. Meanwhile, we were using Gmail and a web host in Australia that cost like, you know, $25 a month or something. So it was almost hilarious if it weren't such a pain in the ass to deal with. And net net, where we stand right now, I have got the order to dismiss the case is just about entered, or it's just about finalized in California, at which point I become a judgment creditor of Perfectus for over $600,000. But now I've got to stand behind the U.S. government, which has got like a $1.8 billion claim. So I'm probably never going to get paid. And net-net, because we didn't publish this as Muddy Waters and we didn't have the brand, net-net, we've lost money on this.
I'm really proud of the work we did. I think it showcased some of the best on-the-ground investigative techniques that short sellers have ever used.
This project was definitely one of the most intellectually interesting and challenging projects, drawing on a wide variety of investigative resources and techniques.
Yeah, I'll never forget like the excitement when we got the pictures back from the trucks in Vietnam and were able to zoom in and see the bills of laning, and we'd followed those ships, you know, all the way from the port in China. Yeah, it was really remarkable.
Looking back, very proud that this work led to the criminal convictions of the companies or some of these entities. Note that Leo's as individuals did not appear, nor did Zhongguang. And also Zhongguang as of filming has its stock suspended because it's unable to file first half numbers. So that might be a direct consequence of this finding of criminal liability. To me, the part that's really important is just this systemic issue here. So this isn't just another stock fraud out of China. This is an intimate look into how Chinese banks have been used to finance illegal dumping of commodities in the U.S. That, to me, is the part that, unfortunately, the DOJ is not going to get to, because at best, it looks like it'll stop with the Leos. But what I just know in my bones, but unfortunately cannot prove, is that very senior members of China's leadership were in on this, and that this is in furtherance of China's undeclared or unspoken economic war against the United States.
So, of course, when it finally comes to conclusion and, you know, all of the assertions are affirmed either by journalists or through Department of Justice action or stock halts, etc., that's very satisfying. But certainly as a capital management company, you know, we're much more enthusiastic about shorts that also provide a great return of capital.
Yeah, unfortunately not financially rewarding, or it turns out a great return on time spent over the last 6 years for members of the team. But that's how short selling can be sometimes. And yeah, the wheels of justice turn slowly, but they do eventually turn. And I don't think the Leos are going to be popping up in the U.S. anytime soon as a consequence. So that's good.
So I think this is a good win for the brand. And hopefully people will realize that when we do this work, we're very thorough, we're very diligent, and we find things that very much need to be brought out into the open. And we'll keep that in mind as we continue to investigate the market.
Yeah, we hear sometimes situations like these where it's not a win, stock price, bro. But I'm okay with that. We get the convictions.